Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art. It is actually...
Very good, lovely reaction, guys.
You can hear the crowd because this is a Talk Art Live.
Talk Art Live!
Hooray!
Where are we live from, Robin? How are you today?
We are live from Venice, and not just any old Venice. We're at the St. Regis Hotel, and we're here with Burberry and the British Council for a very special reason, because it's the Venice Biennale.
And what is the Venice Biennale, Rob?
Well, you tell me.
Well, Biennale means every other year. It is lovingly referred to as the Art World Olympics. Venice Biennale was started in 1895. It's been going for 129 years. I ever heard someone today say that they love the Venice Biennale. They go every year. There are 75 countries represented, 331 artists reps, but if you put collectors in there, it's closer to 400. And the visitors are approximately 300,000 every year.
And you asked me how I'm feeling, which is how every episode begins. And today I am feeling like an art nerd. Ugh. Because we don't just have one guest today who is one of the most important living artists of our time, in my opinion. But we do also have a very impressive curator who, over the past decade since studying at the RCA, has really broken new ground in art. And there's also a theme within today's guest work about collaboration. And I think since the beginning of his career 4 decades ago in the 1980s, he has been part of the Black Audio Film Collective and Smoking Dog Films, and has collaborated with some amazing people, Lena Gopal, David Lawson, even his son, Ashley. And the curator who we're going to be speaking to as well actually studied his work for her master's, and it's a really beautiful thing to think of their collaboration and these two minds coming together, different generations but shared experiences. And I'm also really fascinated by the idea of water as memory and holding memory and the complexity of memory. And I think over the past 40 plus years, our guest's contribution to contemporary art, to film, but also to audio and sound, and how important sound is as an art form in its own right. And I was recently at the Royal Academy and saw a work that was previously shown here in 2015. And I want to talk about that later because it is exquisite. And the accuracy and precision in sound and video was just mind-blowing. So we are very proud to welcome the one and only Sir John Acumphra and Torini Malik.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello. Wow.
How are you feeling? So it officially opened yesterday. Yeah. You've been here for a few days prior to that, or a while before that. How are you feeling right now, both of you?
Well, maybe I should start with an apology. My voice is a little croaky because we had our party last night, and it was a fun one. So I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good to be here. Your enthusiasm is very infectious, and really honoured by the way you introduced us. And so thank you so much.
How are you, John?
Fragile.
Are you?
but good. Fragile, but good, I think.
To be expected, was you sort of warned that you'd get this fatigue, this fragility that would happen from this situation?
Dude, no one prepares you for this. Mm. It's a bit like death, really.
Wow.
You come to it alone. I've had a great time, but the inescapable fact is that it is exhausting and grueling and challenging and just incredible fun as well. I don't want to kind of downplay that. Incredible fun, but hard.
If you got asked to do it again then, would you really consider it?
No.
You wouldn't do it again?
No. Why would you? No, but I mean, I think it's also important to, you know, as all legacies are, it's important to feel as if you've had your moment and that you've passed the thing on. You know, I don't really want to repeat it because that means you're denying somebody else the chance and the right to be in that spotlight. So, yeah, no, I wouldn't go back.
Was it a big surprise when you were asked to represent Britain?
Truthfully?
Yes.
Yes. And because I had done, I think, two biennials before the Ghana Pavilion. And I did that because I didn't think I was ever going to be asked, to be honest, by Britain to represent it. So I took it because of that. And so, yeah, it was a major surprise. A major surprise.
How did it come to you? Was it by email? Did you get a call from...
I think what happens is that you usually get called, but before you've been spoken to, if you have a gallery, they've gone behind you sneakily, the British Council, and spoken to the to your gallery to ask them whether you were, I think, one up to it, to whether you would say yes and blah, 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 blah. You know, so it's belt and braced before the offer is put to you. And yeah, that's exactly how it happened. Right. So the Listen had been asked whether I'd be up for it.
And Listen's your gallery, who represents you.
Listen is my gallery, and Louise had said, yes, I suspect. And so I was asked. And I was very honoured to be asked. I mean, you know, afterwards, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, didn't you think there was something wrong with being the British Pavilion? I'm like, no, there's nothing wrong with being the British Pavilion. In fact, there's everything right in a person of colour who's spent their lifetime, you know, challenging narratives about Britishness, being asked to be in the British Pavilion. So, yeah, I was very honoured to be asked. Mm.
John, I've always thought of you as a poet, so I know we all know of you as an artist, but for me, when someone said, what are you doing in Venice? I said, I'm interviewing a poet, because I feel like your work has this poetry. And I think this Biennale in the British Pavilion, it's really the culmination of the whole of your life's work. It feels like a life's kind of commitment to something. And I know that the title is called Listening All Night to the Rain. And I wanted to kind of start there, this idea of language and the importance of poetry to you.
Very important to me. And in fact, both the name and the working method draw their inspirations from two poets. So Xu Dongpo, a Chinese 11th century poet, is the figure who gave us the title, because he had this extraordinary poem that I thought summarized both the mood and the method that we needed to adapt for this piece. And the other is Ezra Pound. Now, Pound is not very popular these days. You know, he was obviously an anti-Semite and Nazi supporter in place, fascist supporter rather. But he did write one of the most extraordinary books of poetry ever. And the method of the cantos, you know, this idea that you have a theme that you want to pursue, but you have it broken up into fragments that are interlocked, that refer to each other, using, you know, basically tropes of repetition and recall, was very important for what, how we worked on this. So, yeah, poetry is very, very, very central to how I work. Basically, you've kind of fingered me in a way. That's what I wanted to be, but I wasn't a very good one. So I stopped writing. But that approach, that way of seeing the world, of trying to draw conclusions about it in epigrammatic phrases, is something that I'm very interested in. Yeah.
And how does the title, Listening All Night in the Rain, play into this exhibition specifically?
Well, I mean, for one, it alludes you to the key trope of the exhibition, which is the idea of listening itself as a sort of active act, if you will. There is certainly the idea of liquidity that rain basically conjures up. That's central. And lastly, I think just the sense that you've got someone who's in a space of reflection, giving themselves over to something more elemental, something more fundamental, are all things that are interesting for me. So when you go through it, you see that there are several figures basically just standing in places of liquidity, essentially waiting to be told something by the elements, you know, or recalling something in the elements. And that's a sort of key visual motif throughout.
And you said you're working this exhibition in cantos. So what exactly is a canto? And I know that there's eight of them throughout this exhibition. And when we come to the pavilion, canto number one is what we see outside the pavilion now. And actually, you've changed the geography of how we enter the pavilion, because we're used to going into it from the front, but we now come to it from the rear of the building. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What exactly is a canto?
Well, I mean, canto basically from Spanish, canciones, means song. But Ezra Pound turned it into a poetry form. You know, it would have usually a set of verses which are meant to be self-contained, as I said, but with the idea that they have some relation to each other. So invariably, cantos appear in poetry as a set. You have three or four or five, and each would deal with a sub-theme, if you will, but that sub-theme will have and bear some relation to the next set of cantos. And I was interested in that idea. I was interested in the idea that you might have eight, initially nine, but it became eight. Eight self-contained pieces, audiovisual pieces that share a number of motifs, share a number of characters and narratives and stories. And I couldn't think of a better way of describing them than as cantos.
And Torini, like, what was it like thinking about the journey of the visitor, the viewer? Because I feel like while we're also listening, we're actually looking, obviously, you know, at these visual you know, depictions on the screen. But I was someone that's visited the Biennale before, obviously not everyone listening has, but I was really, it really shook me going in round the back of the building. And even though you'd experienced something at the front with these two big screens, which had kind of different images appearing, but what was that sort of process like in a curatorial way? What were the conversations you had?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the offset, when John first started talking about the project, he immediately knew that, you know, his approach was to look at the very fabric of the building and consider how one can subvert, how one can challenge, but how one can create a journey through it. So, I mean, from the offset, we were very much in the same place about that. You know, this building has a very prominent position here in Venice. It's literally the highest point on the island, which is really interesting. But it sits at the top of the Giardini, looking out at its sort of European and Western counterparts. And in terms of equity, it takes up a certain amount of space. And you have this incredible vista up the Giardini where it's, you know, this neoclassical 19th century building. So what does it mean to represent your country? What does it mean to occupy a certain amount of space? And what does it mean to put moving image, to put sound, to put a constellation of work, to create a chapters, sequential chapters, within a space which is architecturally kind of challenging, right? So you have these smaller spaces like antechambers, and then you have a large atrium, which is normally what you enter through when you enter into to the British Pavilion. And John, from the offset, in spite of the fact that it is one of the most challenging things to do, knew that he wanted to take up space in a really different way. And I love that, you know, so unapologetic, so ambitious. And he said, I want that basement. And in spite of really, really fighting, we really fought for it. And we really wanted to create that journey. So instead of having that moment where you're kind of hit with the bigger space, it was about creating these kind of overlapping and interlocking moments, a kind of crescendo moment into the larger space and then exiting out. You know, one of the kind of, I suppose, more standardized or normal ways of seeing film in galleries are in black boxes, right? Are in kind of contained spaces that allow you to be immersed into a certain sonic or visual environment. But this space comes with sort of doorways and you know, spaces that are open. And I think that, like, we tried and John, you know, worked in a really kind of experimental and interesting way to think about ways in which both sound and the visual imagery can travel between the different spaces, that ways in which you can create immersive environments that are related to one another. So we kept all the doorways open. We tried to create ambisonic sound environments, but where there were bleeds, where there were runs between these different environments, those are purposeful. And there are poetic connections and visual and sonic connections between the different installations as well.
And it actually vibrates. Like it's one of the most profound experiences I've had this year at the Biennale entering that basement level. Mm. And it feels like this underbelly of an institution, of the fabric of a society somehow. Mm. And these smaller screens, I'd never seen anything like it. Like, yeah. And the way the water is moving across all these different time points, you've got Holbein, you've got kind of archive photography from, you know, British political history and all of these different images, and even like symbols like exclamation marks or question marks, which repeat throughout the show. But a collector of mine wrote to me this morning and said that she burst into tears.
Really?
She spent 10 minutes in there and she burst into tears because there was something about the way that the energy of that basement room was so intense and you can't escape it. It's like this resonance surrounding your body. And I just found that really, I wasn't sure if that was like a deliberate thing or, you know, I'm sure it is, but it, or whether that's
to make people
like
cry.
Yeah. It's deliberate. Yeah.
How do you feel about making people cry?
Pretty good. Sounds great.
Every artist and curator who gets in this space always says it's challenging.
It's
every 2 years
you
read an article and it's like, this space is so challenging. Yeah. But is it because of these open doorways? Why is this space that's built for art so challenging to show art in?
Well, I mean, it's a challenging context anyway. You know, you have to remember that this is not like in a kind of isolated museum or gallery space.
Right.
It's within the fabric of so much happening visually and sonically and, you know, conversationally and theoretically and intellectually and all of these different things. And you're trying to create an experience which both stands out but also fits within a wider conversation too. But it's also the fact that, you know, these aren't big sweeping white cubes or, you know, spaces that you can easily close off. This is a neoclassical 19th century building that in many ways is probably designed to show a kind of salon hang of paintings.
Right.
But actually, you've sort of embraced that in a way. So the way in which John's films are presented, or the cantos are presented in these sculptural constellations. And it's really beautiful hearing you talk about the experience of that friend of yours, because actually these structures that are housing these screens are actually inspired by altarpieces. And so we worked with an incredible architect, Jessica Reynolds from VPPR, who, you know, it's a female-led architectural practice and they do incredible work. But we were actually in like a complete vortex of looking up like Gothic and Renaissance churches and these different kind of panels to think about how images sit alongside of each other. And this, you know, this came from John, and thinking about how you can transform gallery and museum spaces to create spaces that extend and expand this idea of contemplation and reverie and ideas like that as well.
And this exhibition came about because of the commission, or was you already considering, because all your work is research based,
yes,
was you already in the realm of the research that we see in this exhibition, or did this come because of the opportunity?
A combination of both, actually. I mean, in a way, the project that we've ended up with is a product of concerns and reflections that have been going on for three, four decades. You know, the interest in national identities, what constitutes a British one, and what that shuts out or lets in, are recurring sort of themes for me. But others are harking back in a way to the question you asked earlier. Others are kind of in a response to the place, you know, because when you get commissioned to do this, and you're a moving image artist, you're immediately confronted with these questions of how to accommodate that space, how that space is going to accommodate your practice. You know, are you going to try and close things off and make it a series of self-contained pieces, or are they going to, you know, are the rooms going to be open? And if the rooms are going to be open, then you have to deal with these questions of sound bleed and,
yes,
you know, all the rest of it. And in the end, I thought, okay, there are things I want to change about the place. One was to not enter through this grand entrance, because it meant that once you left that large room, there's nowhere else to go. It's a kind of anticlimactic space in a way. And the second was to try and use the downstairs.
Has it been used before, ever?
Once by Mike Nelson, I think. Right. Yeah.
To use the downstairs just to provide a kind of upstairs, downstairs logic to the way the show worked. And to give you a sense of a kind of journey, you know. Now, once you've got to that point, you think, okay, well, yeah, that's already suggesting a piece of work. You know what I mean? Like, you've got a series of rooms, they're going to be open, so that means you're going to have to fill all those rooms.
Yeah, right.
You know? And it felt in the end as if providing there was references, you know, between the different chambers, that we would be fine, you know. But you then have to impose on yourself a series of constraints. So each piece is exactly 30 minutes long.
And it's looped.
It's looped. Yeah. And each piece finishes at exactly the same time, which means that you're able to, when you, let's say, play all six, you're able to just gauge how sound is working, the rhythms of things, and whether they're talking to each other or not. Whereas, you know, if you made them all different lengths, for instance, they'll be stopping and starting at different times, you know, and that would change every hour, you know, so you'd multiply the randomness of how things come and go. And I didn't want that. I wanted a little bit more control. So what you're seeing is both a product of a certain kind of precision, but also freedom. You know, I'm happy to let people wander in and do what they like with it, but within certain constraints.
There's certain words that I've picked up when researching you. Acoustomentology. What? Say it for me.
Acoustomology.
Yes. What is that?
Acoustomology is basically a compound of two words. Acoustic, obviously meaning sound, and epistemology, a theory of knowledge in philosophy. And it's a word that I've borrowed from anthropology, because a number of anthropologists, especially modern anthropologists, were using it to describe how certain groups understand the world through the sonic. You know, so if you can imagine yourself as a Yanomami figure in the Amazon, you know, not necessarily now, but let's say, you know, 50s and 60s, sounds important because it told you something about food source. It told you something about danger. It told you something about the borders of your territory, if you will. So far from it being just secondary to what you see, sometimes it can be more important than what you see. And I'm really interested in that suggestive possibilities of that, you know, how you get people to know the world through sound.
Wow. Another word is bricolage, which is a signature style for you. What exactly is that?
Well, bricolage is a term for describing how discrete elements are put together to create something new. So it's a little bit like collage and mashup and, you know, montage. They're all words that suggest that there are elements that are different, but are being brought together to have a conversation in a new form. And I'm really, really interested in that, partly because that's what moving image work is anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're trying to force locations and characters and identities and stories and so on into, you're trying to fuse them into a new whole. And usually each section is quite discrete and self-contained. But I like it because I like the idea of trying to do something with a tonality and discordant themes and things that are not meant to be together. I like the idea of trying to get things which are not meant to be together to have conversations in which they agree provisionally just to form a new whole and go back to what they're like afterwards. You know, outside of my projects, they can go back to being what they are, but provisionally at least agree to have a conversation together. Because I think that's the only way in which something new emerges, when things that haven't spoken to each other before are forced into a dialogue with each other. That's how anything novel comes about.
So Torini, when you were studying over 10 years ago now, you were really moved by the films of John. What was that? And then would you call today's moment a manifestation that you made this sort of happen?
Well, actually, it was way before that I came across John's work. I actually mentioned it to him earlier today. It was actually when I was much younger and I didn't know anything about contemporary art, and I didn't have anything to do and any money to spend. And I was in Paris and it was cold, and I was waiting for a friend, and I went into the Mediatheque at the Pompidou, and I happened to see one of John's early works.
Oh, wow.
From Black Audio Film Collective, an incredible work called Signs of Empire, which, sorry about my croaky voice, I'm really embarrassed, but... it just completely moved me. It's amazing to be here in Venice and to have an opportunity to really work with one of my heroes. And I know he's going to hate me calling him that. So sorry, John, apologies. But it is wonderful. I think, John's work, the work of Black Audio Film Collective, the work of Lena Gopal and David Lawson and Trevor Matheson and this group of extraordinary people have absolutely paved the way for so many people from the diaspora, people of color. They have taught us about cinema, global cinema, internationalism, geopolitics, and many, many curators like myself would not be in positions if it wasn't for their utter dedication and resistance and affirmation and joy and vigor and just extraordinary work. So it's amazing. This is the first project that John and I have ever worked on. And what a project and what a journey. It's been utterly bonkers. But also, he has just been a really important part of my life and a really important part of my career for a really, really long time. So, yeah, it's amazing.
Did you come on the project at the same time?
No, actually. John was, I think, nominated in December, right, John, of 2022? And I was nominated in April. And it's a different process, actually. So John is the jury, and as he said, they kind of do the sneaky sneak with listen and try and find out if he's free. And then with this position, curators apply. And I would never have applied, but actually I have a great network of other female curators that really support each other. And Lydia Yee, who I was working with at the Whitechapel at the time, was like, you need to work with John. You need to work with John. And I was like, I'm never, ever going to get it. Are you crazy? And
So you had to audition for it?
No, you have to put in like a lot of text and, like a lot of writing. And
you must have had that from when you were studying. So you just sort of pulled that out.
It was actually just really emotional and really gushy, as I clearly am in character. Literally up until midnight that the application was due, Lydia and her partner Christian Markley, who's a wonderful artist as well, were on speakerphone. They were like, press send. And I was like, absolutely not. This is so embarrassing. Mom and dad. And I did, and lo and behold. So yeah, I'm very grateful.
In layman's terms, what is the role of a curator, and especially on this project?
Oh, well, that's actually a good question, because the role of a curator on this project is even more complicated than the role of a curator on any other project. The role of a curator is, for me, ultimately can be best defined as in service to the artist and in service to your audience, really. It is about supporting an artist in their process, supporting, all the many, 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 many hands that go into making not only artwork, but also the exhibition and, bringing together this multitude of different kind of voices that are just, you know, the person that works in marketing and the person that works on the cabling and the person that helps you put together your text. Every part is just as important as the other.
Logistics as well, because this is a city of water.
It
and everything.
Is a city of water.
Nothing gets here quick. All
nothing,
on boat.
Nothing gets here quick, as we have learned. But also, you know, it's about kind of providing the tools that can help your audience access the work in different ways. So that is, you know, writing exhibition texts and guides and thinking about ways in which you can shift and change your language for different platforms. And that is really important because it's an extension of the linguistic structure and the languages that exist within the artwork itself, but you mediate it in different ways. It's about thinking about other ways in which you can expand a program to allow people to access the work. Could it be a conversation like this one, or could it be through a music program or another extended cinema program? So we've been planning an expanded program alongside this project, you know, ways in which we can get people to understand or see the work that don't necessarily have the privilege of being able to come to Venice. There is a lot of privilege involved in coming to an incredible city like this one. That's undeniable. And yeah, I think it's just, you know, I think curator can use a funny role because you're sort of in part therapist, in part laborer, in part mother, child, you know, teacher, matron, all of it.
When it first got announced that, John, you were going to be representing Great Britain, the amount of people that I met who said they had been inspired by your work, or I think many of my artist friends and colleagues felt like your work had given them permission to even create work or to be an artist, which is such an amazing legacy in a way. And I've heard you speak very beautifully on numerous video interviews about your passion as a kid when you were growing up, and you described yourself as a nerd, which I think Russell and I have also described ourselves as. And I loved hearing you talk about Turner, and I know that Holbein's in the show, and there's all these different influences. But when you started thinking about making and contributing yourself, like in the art you were going to make, can you speak a bit about that, if we go back to like the 80s and even Handsworth Songs and kind of all those incredible moments in your career?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I've spoken often enough about the moment of agency, the moment of self-realization. And it is tied to love. It's tied to the passage from love to a kind of disenchantment, you know. Because I've loved watching, you know, art pretty much from the get-go. And there is a moment, and it's almost a kind of psychoanalytic moment, when you realize that in order to get to the next level, in order to just become a human being, you need to realize that the thing you love is the very thing that's going to stop you from getting to the next level, because it doesn't include you.
But you have to give us an example of that then.
Well, okay, so you walk around the Tate as a child and you love everything in it, and you suddenly realize, at some point, you realize there are no black people in it.
Yeah.
None. Mainly. And it's at that moment you think, okay, well, I'm going to have to step away from this in order to just think about how a person of color could figure in a frame in this place. Because just being here and being in it is not helping me. You know, because oftentimes an artwork has to seduce you into thinking that it has always been like this and will be like this forever. Has to seduce you into believing in its aura, rhetoric of permanence.
Yeah.
You know? But you have to find a way of saying, well, actually, I believe you, Turner, but no. Do you know what I mean? You're a figure from the 1820s and 30s. And that means that, you know, somebody working in the 1920s needed to find their own way of coming at this question of light and shade and shadow. And I'm working in the 80s, so I need to do the same. You know, I can't work with the assumption that you are the beginning and the end of everything. which is what art tries to persuade you it's about, you know. So, yeah, it's really the beginning of the 80s that I... And I think this is a generational thing. I'm not sure that I'm... If you speak to any other artist of colour who came of age in the early 80s, we all made the same realisation at exactly the same time. Wow. Like, okay, it's cool to love de Kooning and cool to love Picasso, but hey, how about some black ones? You know? And that's not... I think oftentimes the way in which that militancy is defined is almost in sort of negative terms. It's not. It's not like you don't stop liking Picasso in the 1905, 1915 period. You don't stop liking, you know, Matisse in the kind of, you know, colour, you know, collage phase. But you do realise that you need to create a space of autonomy in which to make something else.
Yes.
Because otherwise you ain't going to exist. It's quite literally a matter of life and death, you know. There's a sort of suffocating embrace that the thing that has denied you brings, you know. And you think, well, I just need to say, thanks, but no thanks. I just need to find my own breath now. Because otherwise nothing new ever happens, you know.
So when did the film become your medium?
Exactly the same time. This is the weirdest thing, you know. So I grew up in West London. I grew up just at the bottom of the Fulham Road. And you go one way and you go to the Tate. And another way, if you walk straight down the Fulham Road, there was a cinema, a rep cinema called the Paris Pullman. And it was there. I mean, it was certainly there when I was 14, 15. I bunked in so many times into this cinema. They're like, dude, just come through the front door. We're tired of you breaking through. Just come. So from the age of like 15, I saw everything. And a lot of the stuff I didn't really get. You know, I remember seeing Tarkovsky. Which one was it? Must have been Mirror. And it just made no sense whatsoever. But I was completely mesmerized by the flow, you know. And the weird thing was that when I was old enough to understand it, I realized that I'd got it all along.
Wow.
You know, oftentimes you get it. You might not have the language for describing what you got, but most of the time you get it. I got the sense that it was about memory, but I didn't know quite how that fitted into. Anyway, so from the beginning, the twin passions run side by side. You know, and I loved them for different reasons. I loved going to the cinema because it was one of those places where the gaze was absent. Like when you're in the cinema, you could literally hide and be yourself. Weirdly. On the street, you know, you're likely to meet a skinhead and you're likely to get into confrontations. And blah, blah, blah. In the cinema, everyone's busy with themselves. They've got no time to hate you. They're just busy trying to engage with something. So it was a great place to be. The art world posed a slightly different challenge in the sense that in order to see it, you have to be with someone. Because galleries are public. And so in order to be in a gallery, you have to assert your right to be there.
Right.
You know? And I liked both gestures. I thought both were interesting. I didn't really have to decide which one, because it seemed to me that you could bring one into the other quite early on. Quite early on, I thought we could make films that were art. You know, and we were prepared, we could make films that way that would either inspire or encourage derision. And we got both in equal measure. So,
this is when you was a student in Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And this was when the collective, the Pioneering Collective, was formed that you're a founder member of.
Indeed, indeed.
And how did that, so there was how many of you at that time? Seven or?
I mean, eight of us.
Eight of you.
Eight of us at Portsmouth at the time. And
there's eight cantos in this exhibition. That's quite interesting.
Oh, yeah.
So how did that conversation go about? Did you all just like get a takeaway and go to someone's front room and go, right, come on, guys, let's pick up a camera? Or how did it work?
Quite literally, we had a squat in King's Cross and lots of conversations about the nature of art and how it needed to be made and what constituted art anyway. You know, I mean, I was one of the members who were completely against the use of the word art, because it just felt to me to be wrong to label what we were going to try and do in advance of doing it. You know, so I was like, no, we don't want to call it film. We don't want to call it art. Let's just, you know, and that was a consistent line that I pursued from the Black Art Conference, which took place in 82 onwards. That was a major, major moment for us, because we went there and suddenly there were another 30 people.
What is the Black Art Conference then?
In 1982, a group of students in Wolverhampton basically put out a call to say, if you are interested in being a black artist, we're going to have a conference, come along. And I think 30 or 40 of us turned
up.
I mean, now it'll be, I don't know, 5,000, no?
Yeah.
But anyway, 30, 40 people turned up. And for a weekend, we tried to thrash out what might look like a manifesto for a black art movement. And people took different positions, you know. The painters invariably are like, well, we should just be artists. Like, sod off. Why are you always so boring? And most other, you know, practitioners were like, okay, well, maybe let's just have a conversation about when we become artists or who we define ourselves as artists to, or, you know. And I, as I said, I was always like, no, let's not even go there. Let's just do what we want to do. And if it's then called art by someone, fine. But, you know, we don't want to get into the business of saying, oh, we're artists, accept us, or let us in, or all of that stuff. You know, just do your own thing. You know, sign a sort of refusenik manifesto, secessionist manifesto. Go off into the bush, do your thing. And if someone calls you to say, hey, look, come in, you're artists, fine. But if not, you just carry on, you know, carry on your rogue practice. And who knows, you know, at some point, you might have enough of you to create a new republic. Who knows? You know?
The thing that I think is so unique about your body of work is the way that it ties together the past, the present, and then the future, like what's to come. And in this installation in Venice, I kept thinking about the past and obsolete technology. And there's this amazing installation as you walk up the stairs. It's almost like, it's kind of like a religious experience when you go upstairs, mm-hmm. because you're surrounded by these. The stairs have all been encased in fabric, so it kind of feels like very velvety. Not velvet, it's like a felt almost. Mm-hmm. And it was these really rich colours as well. So the text is in yellow and purple, which I heard was a reference to Rothko, and I think there's this kind of like history of your love of his painting and your interest in that. Yes. But as I was going up and you suddenly see the sculptural installation, it's hanging from the ceiling, and it's all these objects from the past, like radios and tape, actual...
All obsolete.
Obsolete, like outdated.
Audio objects, yeah.
Yeah, and it got me thinking so much about how wasteful we are. And I know the kind of disaster of, ecological disaster is often a theme that runs under the work. But then it also appears, these telephones, like the old ring telephones from the 80s that I used to remember as a young kid, like being obsessed with as a visual object. Can you speak a bit about that sculptural element and then how it echoes throughout the films?
Yes, I mean... I'm completely fascinated by waste, detritus. And from the beginning, it seemed to me that we needed to say to people something very specific about listening, which is that the act of listening is usually mediated by a sonic object of one kind or another. You know, hearing is free. You know, to hear something, to listen to something usually means you're listening to an object of some kind or another, a sonic object of one form or another, whether it's another voice speaking to you or listen to a radio or TV and so on. So it was always clear that if we wanted to do something about listening, the archaeology of sonic objects needed to figure in it in some way, you know. It just so happened that my friends at Dub Morphology, who I'd asked to do something for it, said they wanted to hang, microphones and speakers from the ceilings. So I thought, oh, perfect. Well, let's see whether we can then embellish what they were going to do. So that rather than having just a series of slightly kind of nude and sorry looking mics, we clothed them in something both familiar and unfamiliar at the same time. You know, but if you, as you go through the show, you see that most of the objects you see hanging also figure quite prominently in many of the shooting scenarios that you've got.
Can we talk about your shoots then, the production days? How does that all come about? And I know that you film a lot in Scotland and Yorkshire. Why is that? That sounds quite negative. Why is that? I'm not being down to Scotland and Yorkshire. Why would you film there?
Good question. Yeah. I mean, I it's weird. I have this very pagan relationship with landscape. You know, I believe that it has properties. I believe that it has voice, that it speaks to you. And some of the places where you feel this very powerfully for me have been spaces of immense tragedies, you know. And the Scottish Highlands is one of those that have been like that for me for a while. I went there first when my mother died in the early mid-90s to work, and I ended up making a film about her there. And something happened, I don't know what it was, but some fusing of my own psychic kind of need for home with that landscape's beckoning and pleading for companionship with me to, I don't, but something happened that made it both a place of refuge and a place of solitude for me. So usually with every project, I kind of ask myself whether to make that visit to the Highlands. And when I do, invariably it says, oh, welcome, come in. I've got something new to show you here. Have you seen that mountain? I'm trying very hard to extend that to other parts of the UK at the moment. So we worked a lot in Yorkshire as well. And I found it's a slightly different spirit, but an equally hospitable spirit all the same, you know. So let's see, you know, who knows? In the next couple of years, I might go all over Leeds or something. I might work in Bradford.
I'm going to go to Margate.
Margate.
Yeah.
You know. But also, Yorkshire was a very specific choice, though, because of trying to, like, uphold the memory of someone that had died in a very violent way. Like, they were beaten by the police. Yeah. His name was David Oluwale, and he was a British-Nigerian man, and he was found in the river in 1969. Mm. And what I thought was really beautiful was that this work is almost like a tribute to his life and to his memory, but this idea of the water itself, and how water can hold memory. Can you speak a bit about that particular story of his life and why you chose to pinpoint that in this particular work?
You are very astute, sir. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is in a way a kind of homage to David Oluwale, because he was... There's something about his story that speaks to the other side of the Windrush narrative, you know, because of course one of the strands of the Windrush narrative has always been, especially for people of color, especially for black people, is that you know, we came and things were hard, and then we settled, and then we had our children, and now we're fine, you know. And the Oluwale story tells a slightly darker tale of how the unhomely became a feature of our existence, really. He was a Nigerian man who stowed away in 1949 to England and for some reason decided to settle in Leeds, which had a slightly unfortunate side effect for him. One, because there wasn't a really huge community at the time in Leeds. And so he stood out. And he stood up particularly for a number of reasons. I think he found it difficult to adjust anyway, you know. So he had, you know, he started having kind of mental problems, which immediately meant that he was plunged into a space of uncertainty and vagrancy. So he lost his house, job, and, you know, before you know it, he's in that space of the strange. And that then brought him into contact with the Leeds police, who then made it their job to basically terrorize this poor guy and routinely beat him, routinely urinated on him, all kinds of stuff, you know. So much so that when he saw the Leeds police, he would run. And one of the end results of that was that one fateful night when they came for him, he took off and they chased him, and he fell into a river and drowned, you know. So the idea of black bodies in water became immediately a sort of motif for this project, you know. Not just because Oluwale met his fate in it, but it seemed to summarize something about the nature of our existence in this place, you know. I don't mean it just in a negative sense. You know, there's a film that I love a lot by Andrei Tarkovsky, you wouldn't be surprised to know, called Solaris. And in a section of Solaris, it becomes clear that, you know, these guys who've been sent to a new planet were being played with by the planet, because the planet, which was covered by water, had this way of creating them, creating images of them, you know, doubles of them and so on. And in a way, this project's haunted by that idea, the idea that somehow you've got characters who may well have been conjured up by water. They might not be quite real. They might be, you know, how water remembered us, you know. I was really fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by the idea of the in-between, by things that are thrown up almost in surreal-like ways that are impossible things, you know. Figures stand in water is an impossible image. You know, no one stands in water. So if you choose to stand someone in water, it's for a reason or a function or, you know. And to make that a driving force for anything then becomes an interesting proposition.
And when we met you the other day, Tuesday or Wednesday, I think it was Tuesday actually, we were talking about this idea of the oceans having been there long before we even existed. Yeah. and how they'll live, the ocean will be there long after we've all, you know, indeed, gone.
And the water has memory.
And the water having memory and this kind of science behind all of that. Yeah. And how someone has disproven that, you know, water, of course it can't have memory, but then it spoke to you, that idea.
Yeah. No, sorry, I forgot to. I was going to tell you that in the beginning, but then I forgot. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was the beginning of the project was also the beginning of my interest in a debate that took place in the 80s, which was called the Memory of Water Debate. And essentially what the debate centered on was an article that a French immunologist called Jacques Benveniste wrote for Nature magazine, in which he argued that water had memorial properties, water had memory. And I think the conversation we were having was along the lines of, one, he was told he was wrong, which is true scientifically, because his thesis was tested in laboratories, countless laboratories, and no one could quite make the connections that he was trying to make. But it just seemed to me to be, you know, especially now, a slightly facile discussion to have about memory and water, you know, because, you know, look, you're talking about like the biggest mass. Uh-huh, water is talking to us.
The light's just gone down. Yeah. Moody.
As the building sinks a tiny bit. Yeah. We are in
the city of water.
That's a joke, by the way.
Is it?
Yeah, that's alleged.
I think it is actually sinking. Okay.
It quite literally is sinking.
No, yeah. It feels like it is.
Well, it reminded me, actually, talking about the memory of water, of a fact I read once, that every glass of water we drink has at one point or other been peed out by a dinosaur.
There you go.
Whoa.
And I mean, if that isn't memory, and you can think about that every time you have a glass of water now.
Thank you. Peed, but also, like...
True.
All kinds of dead stuff in it.
Yeah.
Going back in. Because it's the same. Now, the water's not gone anywhere. It's the same water that, you know, made this a habitable place that a couple of million years ago, it's still around. It's the same. It's not gone anywhere. So the idea that it doesn't have memory, i.e. deposits and traces of other things, not sure that's true.
What happens now, Tarina? Is this like the end for you? You get to go home, or is there lots of things going on? Because the exhibition goes on until November.
It does.
Are you back and forth to Venice? Do you do things in London?
Yeah, we're back and forth to Venice for lots of different things. We've got a book to make, which is very exciting. which we need to do. We're trying to, you know, like I kind of said earlier, we're trying to think about ways in which we expand the reach of the show. And you know, one of the wonderful ways in which you can do that is online. And one of the wonderful things about film is that it can sit on lots of different kinds of platforms, and it has a kind of openness to it, which is kind of beautiful. So we have things coming up. Yep, we're doing screenings at the ICA.
Great.
Which is really exciting. We're looking at making a record with some of the kind of sonic elements. And John mentioned that, you know, Dub Morphology, who, you know, he's had a relationship with, you know, which spans, and friendship with, that spans, you know, at least four decades. And the show has this incredible acoustic quality to it. So we're looking to see if we can expand that and think about it. We're looking at possibly performance. We're looking at trying to do something in London that honors the kind of collectivism and the community of Black Audio Film Collective, and John's kind of foundational way of working, which still very much exists in a different way, but exists today. And trying to bring in people across different disciplines, like writers and musicians and filmmakers and designers and other artists, and to come together in a space in London in which, you know, we might talk and we might perform and we might watch things and we might listen to things. Lots to come, lots to still do. And I think, you know, like the show being open is just the beginning of the journey, right? Like, you know, it's seeing how people interact with it, seeing, you know, what they think, what they like, what they don't like. It's all part of a kind of learning experience, and I think the work and the ideas within it will take on different lives as well.
Great. Are you thinking about the next project already, or are you giving yourself a bit of a...
A bit of a break.
Yeah.
A
break.
Fair enough.
I mean, it's just so big, this one, that... took a bit out of me, so I think a break is in hand.
We've got artists, listeners, like all over the world, and a lot of them are sometimes like on their own, and they might be at the beginning of their journey, or they might have been doing it for like 40, 50 years, who knows? We meet all different age groups. But I was really struck by both of your experiences, how important collaboration is, and how togetherness, and even the idea of family, maybe chosen family, or actually like blood relations, because I know your son is a big collaborator of yours for the last kind of 10, 15 years, I think.
Yes.
Can you speak a bit about why collaboration is a great thing to have as an artist? Because even though it's your name up there, you know, it's not just you. It's like it's been possible because of all these other people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm happy to speak about that. There's a way in which how you enter something defines really what you're going to do with that thing, really. And it was clear that we weren't the first group of artists of color to have come onto the scene in this country, you know, in the 80s. Because we'd met, you know, you either had uncles or aunts or people you meet in the bar, you know, usually drunk, saying, oh, I was an artist once. Yeah. So for many of us in Black Audio, the Black artist was a tragic, solitary figure who just knocked their heads against the machine and lost, you know. And collective practice was one of the ways we thought we might use to circumvent this drama of, you know, decline. And I think we were right to do that. So, I mean, just literally every time I speak to people who are thinking of this, I say the same things to them, you know, just go and find a group of people who broadly think the same as you and work with them. Mm. You know, you don't have to necessarily be a collective, but just collaborate with them. You know, do your own thing, but they do their thing. And, you know, but try and have some group that in the end legitimizes your practice. Because it's very difficult. It's very difficult to live with uncertainty. It's very difficult to live with, you know, randomness, you know, when you have no way of gauging whether it's good for you, holding you back, or, you know, basically making things work for you. And if you have witnesses, if you have, you know, other voices, someone can say, yeah, do your thing. It's good. It's not bad, you know? Do you know what I mean? It's like a way of affirming self by having, weirdly enough, relations with others, which paradoxically you would have thought had the opposite effect. You know, you'd think working with other people means that you don't have a self, but actually it's one of the ways one uses to affirm, you know, individuality. It's by having other people go,
thumbs up,
you're doing well.
And one of your biggest collaborators is Lena Gopal, and we met Lena today. We had the great honour, and I was actually like a fangirl, essentially. I was like, oh my God, you're Lena. I loved meeting her, and she's amazing. But you actually fell in love, and was that through art? Like, did you meet through art?
Quite literally.
Really?
quite literally. We
Lena
met.
Looks really embarrassed.
Sorry,
right now.
Yeah. I think it's really important to shout out Lena, because we love her.
We met, I think, as 18-year-olds in one of the first experimental women's studies courses. We were both at this Federal Education College in the East End, and I don't know how and why we both wandered into this course, but we did, and did it as a kind of GCSE. And it was the most extraordinary course, because here I was, a young black kid, male, learning all this stuff that were literally revolutionary. I'm like, really? Seriously? Like, men did this? or just learning the idea that what I assumed was quote unquote natural wasn't at all, but constructed and made and socially defined. You know, that was like a, you know, to be an 18-year-old and learning that was like a major, major insight for me. So we met in that space of constructing new identities by learning about a new subject matter, feminism. And
was you the only man there, or was there many
yes.
men? Was you?
Really?
That's amazing.
And so what used to happen after a while was, you know, we started with a book called Against Our Will, which is a book about the history of rape. And it was written by a woman called Susan Brown Miller. And her thesis basically was that rape was a tool men used to oppress women. Mm. And it was just filled with the most graphic, harrowing stuff. And as our teacher, the late feminist Liz Waugh, read it, everyone would turn and look at me. Mm. Like, oops, sorry. It was uncomfortable. But I mean, like all new things, it was necessary to feel uncomfortable, because otherwise I wouldn't have learned anything at all. And I did learn a lot in that year, you know, about myself, about the world, about the nature of gender, you know, politics and, you know, the whole thing.
That's an incredible story. What an amazing wherewithal to have at that age to be like, indeed, I want to go and study that. And
yeah, I mean, put it this way, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I knew it was, I mean, I wanted it to be something that explained the world to me, but I didn't think it would be quite so revolutionary. You know, it changed literally the way I thought about the world. I hadn't realized that, you know, the question of gender was so central to how our societies were organized.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned that much more explicitly first before I learned about questions of race, weirdly enough.
At what point did you have your first date then?
When I plucked up the courage to say, do you want to come home with me and see, you know, see my family? And she was like, yeah, okay. Oh.
That was the first date? She met the family?
Yeah.
Because
we were trying to be... We're 18.
You don't do things by halves, John. That's straight in.
I love that idea of curiosity. I think curiosity is something that politically governments try and shut down. Like, they actually don't want people to be curious, to explore, to have their minds, you know, expanded like you did at that age, you know, of 18. And that's why I think art education has to be, you know, at the forefront of everything. And also feeding kids in school so they can actually, you know, have the absolutely energy in the morning to think absolutely at school. But I feel like it's such a, you know, vital thing. So I love that you've... your curiosity has also led to all of our interest as well in curiosity. So thank you.
Thank you. No, I mean, just to wander out into spaces of discomfort in which, you know, illuminating insights can be had was not something I was consciously thinking of. But in retrospect, yes, that was, I've gained the most wandering into these spaces, you know, and not feeling intimidated. Overly intimidated, let's say, by it, You know, I remember going to Rwanda just after the genocide, and it was almost terminal, put it that way, because I looked like the people who had committed the genocide, and there was a lot of anger in Rwanda at the time. But had I not gone, I wouldn't have learned something about the nature of political power in Africa, really. It was an extraordinary moment to see a group that had suffered, you know, lost thousands, try to create a society, you know, and yeah, that becoming was really important to me, because I suddenly realized, yes, if these people can do it, then we can all do it. You know, like if from the throes of the most appalling tragedy, you can create something, then it's possible for all of us, really.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, we're going to get into our final questions now. Thank you, guys. This has been wonderful. The first question we ask every guest is for both of you. If you could do an art heist, you could steal any artwork in the world for yourselves, what would it be and why? Yes. I'm going to start with you, Tarini.
I wish I prepped. Okay. An art heist. What would I steal? Oh my God, I was about to say something really. I was going to say Wrath of the Medusa by Jericho.
Great.
Yeah.
Love your piece.
And why that work?
No, have you seen it in the flesh?
Yes, I have seen it in the flesh. I think it's just the human drama of that piece is so extraordinary. And maybe it's because we've had water on the brain for the last year. But it's that kind of idea of like the violence of kind of both man and nature together. It's such a cinematic painting. I know that word gets thrown out a lot when we look back now and we talk about art history, but it truly is. It's just moving, and it's one of those. And I see it as cinematic also because I feel like where it's like a really embodied kind of experience looking at that painting, because depending on where you stand, I feel like you see different gestures in that human drama, or you see a different interaction, or the kind of expression in a figure's face will shift, or it's just an extraordinary painting. So yeah, that one.
All right, we'll get that for you.
Yeah, that's thank fine. You.
And John?
Thank
John?
You.
I mean, the one she wants to steal is a huge painting.
It's a biggie, yeah.
we're going to bring cranes.
It's one of the biggest.
We're going to bring cranes.
So you need to find a crane.
Helicopters.
It's done. Don't even mention it. It's done. It's happening.
I want something more modest. I think I'll just steal Mantegna's Dead Christ.
That's would a good, be good one, John.
That would be good to take, because it's not too big.
Mm. But where is that located in the world?
Do you know what? I don't know now. Definitely somewhere in Italy. For sure.
But you've seen it yourself in the flesh as well?
No, never seen it. Seen it. I've only ever seen it in monographs but you know, the power of Mantegna's Dead Christ never leaves you. Once you first see it, you go, whoa, okay, so that's a dead figure. Christ really does look dead. You know, the mortality of Christ is absolutely to the forefront of this painting. For me, it's the first modern painting, actually. And that's one of the reasons I so love it. The flatness of it, you know, that will become the kind of thing, the Gauguin, you know, much of Impressionism is founded on the sort of flattening that Mantegna's Dead Christ is about. But that's what's called a kind of realism, which wasn't one of the features of that period in Italian painting. It's just an extraordinary painting.
Well, that's yours.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour? And I feel like this is really pertinent because of the Biennale and your pavilion, because colour between the video screens and the kind of grading of those colours with the walls and even the objects and all of that, it was a very sensory experience to do with colour, I think. So what is your favourite colour, each of you?
Who's going first? Okay, what's my favourite colour? You know, and I think this is actually influenced by the sound sculpture, but at the moment it's red. I think I loved how you described coming up into that room and seeing these objects in, you know, and normally that room, it can So this is, I suppose, boring to listen to if you haven't seen it, but the room that we're describing basically is kind of an odd one. It's like oblong, and it has one entire wall is essentially covered with glass, and it has really high ceilings, but it's narrow. And we took out the floor and we put this staircase in for the first time, and we were thinking about all of these objects hung from the ceiling, and we wanted that room to be tones of red inspired by Rothko. So as you say, we have this kind of layered color field, and it feels so enveloping, like you're kind of stepping up into a kind of another sphere or another world. And then that red really makes me think of art history, you know, like the reds in Caravaggio, or you know, the reds that you'll find in a really kind of opulent church, but like, you know, the red in like human drama. And red is often a really strong motif in the history of cinema, as an example, and its passion and its violence and its gore and its red.
It also made me think about birth. I was thinking about birth.
Like a womb, I suppose, the two
extremes.
Absolutely.
Which is what you said earlier, we all go through alone in a way.
Indeed. For me, without question, always purple.
Yeah.
And purple is just my absolute favorite. Because of its indeterminacy, for one, because purple is really a combination of blue and red, as you know, and so it speaks in betweenness, you know. But purple was also one of the is one of the colors that tells you something about our changed relationship with color itself. 16th, 17th, 18th century, only a certain number of people had access to that color. It's a very rare color, only worn by certain figures, only seen by certain figures. You couldn't, you know. And so part of the democratizing of our relationship with color, 20th century and now, is the predominance and the prevalence of purple, you know. So I love it for all those reasons. It's like,
what is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
Make mistakes frequently and be comfortable with it.
Have you made mistakes in this exhibition?
All the time.
And you're comfortable with those?
Yeah, I go out my way to make mistakes now.
Do you?
Absolutely. Because you have to unlearn and learn through the unlearning. Otherwise, there's no point. Otherwise, you end up kind of parodying things. Make mistakes. It's good.
Tarini?
The best advice for curators? I think that the most important resource you have, without sounding cheesy, is really each other. Like, the most important relationships have, for me now in my career and in my practice, have been the relationships that I came up with and were my peers, and the people that I really struggled with together. Those are the people that have influenced the way I work, the things that I advocate for. Those are the people that have pushed me to do things that I haven't felt comfortable with. And we've talked about discomfort, and I love that you talk about discomfort so much, because I actually think that's one of the most useful feelings actually ever. So yes, it's to keep your friends close.
And your enemies closer.
And your enemies closer, exactly, which there are many in the
world. Is that why you work with me, Russ?
Yeah, exactly. Well, before we finish, I just want to read the little poem by Su Dong Po that the exhibition title comes from, if that's okay. I'm like a little boat, sensing an expanse of endless water, here under groves of trees, face to face in the bedroom, listening all night to the rain. Beautiful. Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We'd also like to thank Burberry for bringing us over here, and
British Council
for commissioning. We love you. But it's been an amazing trip. We've had a great time in Venice. We've done over 40,000 steps a day.
We really have as well. That's not even a joke. And I think we've seen more art than I've seen in about 10 years. And I actually feel healed by it. It's like a beautiful thing. Listening All Night to the Rain runs from the 20th of April, which is actually today on the podcast, because that's when we're releasing the episode. And it runs until the 24th of November. And if you can anyway somehow get here, maybe come with friends, maybe like share a hotel room, anything you can do to get to Venice, it's really worth it. And thank you so much, Sir John Okumfor, because you are a leading light, and I know that you've changed so many people's lives for the better. Yeah. And we're very grateful for you. And thank you to Rini Malek. And we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Burberry. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.